Welcome to this LSE Ideas webinar, one of many we've of course been holding throughout the whole period of COVID, and no doubt we'll continue to do so after now we've discovered the wonders of Zoom. It has many advantages and some downsides, but I think this proves yet again some of the advantages. We can bring together people from different parts of the world. Every COVID crisis, I suppose, has a little silver lining, and this might be one of them. The topic we're looking at today is, I think, a deeply important one, and one that we need to discuss probably more, because there's so much focus on China and the United States and China in its own region, that we need to look at China outside of that those two relationships, and particularly at China in Europe, and specifically, as we're going to look at today, China's foreign policy relationship to Central and sometimes called Eastern Europe, but I call it Central Europe because that's in the title. We've been hosting discussions on China for a very long time within LSE Ideas, and I'm very pleased that Dr. Yu Ji is here today because she was the person many, many years back, not too far, Cherry, back in 2011. It feels a long time, doesn't it? Who actually launched our China Foresight program at LSE Ideas, and it's wonderful to have her again with us today. She's still very much associated with LSE Ideas, but is now, as I know you probably know, Senior Research Fellow in China and the Asia Pacific Program. We have two other wonderful speakers, Edward Lucas. I noticed today on your CV, Edward, you did a degree at the LSE, from which I congratulate you yet again, as I do to everybody. I'm very patriotic when it comes to the school. But Edward has a long-time interest in Central Europe, Eastern Europe, Russia. His best-selling book, 2008, A New Cold War, almost prescient, some would argue, reprinted, and very popular, very influential. Edward has also written for The Times and for The Economist, and I think has made a big contribution to the whole debate about what's going on in Central Europe and indeed within Russia, and what we in the West or wherever should be doing about it. Our second speaker, and it's lovely to have you here, Ivana Karaskova, is a founder and leader of Choice and China Research Fellow at the Association for International Affairs in Prague. She was a Fulbright Scholar at Columbia University, holds a PhD in international relations from the Faculty of Social Sciences, many, many other things before, but clearly one of the great Central European Czech specialists, I should also add, Ivana, on what is happening in China. And if you follow Ivana on her webpage, you'll see how much she's been writing on China, China's external relations. Wonderful to have you here today, Ivana. And then finally, last but by no means least, I've already introduced you, but I'll do it just briefly again, Cherry, Dr. Yu Ji, who's now based at Chatham House. So the topic for today is going to be China and 16 plus one, which I now think is called 17 plus one, once Greece joined it. I look back at the history of this and I have a sort of great interest in Central Europe. I recently wrote about the Trianon Conference of 1920 for my sins as part of my interest in this. And part of the things we're doing in Ideas is with Central and Eastern Europe. And in a way, this is a joint project between our great program we now have running on Central, East, and Southeastern Europe and our China Foresight program. But if you look back, if you look at the history of 16 plus one, I'm not going to go through it. It began really with the first summit meeting. I think this is right to say, Ivana, it began with the first summit meeting in 2012 in Warsaw. It continued in Bucharest and continued then in Dubrovnik, Sofia. In essence, however, wherever the meetings are held, it is first and foremost, I think, if this is fair to say, a China initiative in the first instance back in 2012 to promote business investment, infrastructure, transport, and logistics. And I suppose two or three questions arise, and I'll move over to Edward in one moment to get your answers to these questions, Edward, and you will obviously have your own take on this as well. What has it achieved economically? Is it a promise that has not been realized? How does it fit in to China's famous Belt and Road Initiative? How does it situate itself within that larger grand strategy of the People's Republic of China? And is there anything behind it? I mean, you read quite a lot of the material today on it, and that whereas China tends to view it as a win-win relationship with Central and East European countries, there's no doubt that there is a growing pushback against it in some countries, at least in Central Eastern Europe, not all, and certain suspicion that this is really divide and rule. And of course, it's created a certain degree of pushback from a number of countries in Europe itself. So it's a very important institution. We don't talk enough about it outside of the region, I think. China, I know, does do a lot of analysis of it. I know people like Ivana and Edward have done a lot of analysis of it, as indeed has Cherry. So, Edward, I'll hand over to you first for your reflections on what's going on, where you think it's going to, and how you sense the future of this. So, Edward, very nice to have you here today.
Well, thanks very much indeed for that. And it's always an honour to be involved in anything with LSE, because it makes me feel young and clever, because that's at least what I certainly felt. I was young and I had more intellectual energy 30 something years ago when I was at LSE. So thank you for inviting me. I think it's quite useful to look at this in terms of sort of 5 to 10 year perspective. And if you cast your mind back to say 2017 or 2015 and then see where we are now, there's a really sharp change, and it's not gone China's way. In 2015, China was not on the radar as a threat for really anyone apart from sort of professional hawks like me. And the Chinese Communist Party had quite successfully managed to push countries in Central Eastern Europe away from their ties with the Tibetan exiles, the Dalai Lama, who'd in 2005 could visit any country in the region. By 2015 was meeting the mayor of Wrocław and other sort of, you know, second and third tier dignitaries. And the 17+1 was uncontentious in those days, though it had some impressive sounding projects. There were particularly the Budapest to Belgrade railway, other projects as well. And it seemed to fit into the general idea that China was a very important economic partner. It was a large cake. Everyone should have their slice. And this was the way that the East Europeans would get their chunk of the trade and investment benefits going with that were there for the taking. It was, I wouldn't say apolitical, but it was largely depoliticized. And perhaps the sort of highlight of that was when Greece joined and turned it from the 16 to the 17+1. But in fact, I think now it's going very much in reverse. We've seen, for a start, the numbers have changed, and Lithuania's formally pulled out, and Estonia says its cooperation is at a minimum, and the Latvians will no doubt follow suit. And so the most recent 17+1 summit was a real disaster. Xi Jinping played sort of double or quits and said, I want people to be represented at head of government or head of state level because I'm going to be there. And the East Europeans just didn't go along with that. And there was, I think, six countries didn't follow the instruction. Some of them sent really quite sort of ostentatiously junior representatives. And the political temperature has changed very much. It's now seen as a Chinese influence operation, an attempt to play divide and rule in Europe. And the kind of awkward squad within 17+1 are saying, no, we want 27+1. If we're going to deal with the EU, we're going to deal with it as the EU rather than as some kind of subgroup. And along with that, we see a very sharp pushback on some of the things that matter most in symbolic terms to the Chinese Communist Party. Perhaps most spectacular was the Czech delegation going to Taiwan. The third most senior official in the Czech Republic, Mr. Vystrčil, taking a 90-strong delegation to Taiwan, making a speech in the Taiwanese legislature in the teeth of opposition from the Chinese Communist Party. But we've also seen similarly pro-Taiwan Statements coming out, notably from the Lithuanians, but also from others, and that's a real snub to the kind of Chinese taboo on political contacts with Taiwan. And I think it demonstrates an important point, which is that the hegemonic discourse control, which is a hallmark of Xi Jinping's diplomacy, is extremely effective when it works, but very fragile when it doesn't. It only takes someone to say the emperor's got no clothes. And it looks very vulnerable. So when the Czech delegation went to Taiwan in the summer of last year, people said, oh my goodness, you know, they're going to get the full wrath of the party state will descend on the Czech Republic. A lot of people thought, again, planes are going to be cancelled, exports, trade, whatever. And in fact, almost nothing happened. There was, I think, one contract for pianos was cancelled. Ivana will know this in more detail. But in the end, China huffed and puffed, but it could not blow the house down. And we see also with Lithuania, actually, nothing much is happening, because in the end, the cost of these things is greater than the benefit. And I think that underlines the second point, which I think is important and perhaps quite controversial, that for China, this is not actually a huge priority. We've, I think, tended a bit to over-focus on Chinese influence in Eastern Europe, because you can imagine how it might turn into something really important. And so there's been lots of attention on 17+1, on Chinese Serbian, Chinese Hungarian, Chinese Belarusian, Chinese Ukrainian relations. But actually, from a Chinese point of view, this is much less important than it is from the point of view of the countries concerned. So in Serbia, you have these sort of huge posters up in Belgrade saying, thank you, hvala, brat Xi, thank you, brother Xi, for the tremendous support that China has allegedly given Serbia during the pandemic. Very similarly performative pro-China diplomacy by Viktor Orban and by Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus. And that certainly has a role for them. It's a way of them saying to the West, watch out, we have options. Maybe a way for them saying to Russia, hey, we have options. But you don't see posters up in Beijing saying, hello, brother Sasha, thank you, mighty Serbia, for your great role as the gateway to Chinese influence in Europe. And when I was doing my report with Bobo Low on called Partnership Without Substance, looking at the details of Chinese and Russian interaction or lack of it in Eastern Europe, one person we said to, sadly off the record, was government official, so we couldn't quote him. But he said, China would sacrifice the entire 17+1 for better relations with North Rhine-Westphalia or Bavaria or Belgium or somewhere in Western Europe. And it's true that China did think that Central and Eastern Europe might be a gateway, a back door to Western Europe. But the point about a back door is you go through it because you can't get through the front door to get to a particular destination. And it's in Western Europe that the money, the political influence, all the important stuff is. And we've also been struck by how incompetent the Chinese diplomacy has been. I think China, or at least the Chinese Communist Party, finds it difficult to deal with small countries generally, and they're not instinctively multilateralist. And again, when you look beneath the bonnet of the 17+1, you find all sorts of stuff that doesn't work. A network of think tanks, for example, launched with great fanfare, but there's no website. Offices that are supposed to be in charge of logistics and cultural ties and this and that. And when you actually send a reporter to go and look, the office is shut, no one's ever been there, it's just a plate on a door. So there's a sort of vast nothing burger of Chinese influence which when you poke it really doesn't amount to very much. And the Wolf Warrior diplomacy has been really quite counterproductive, I think, moving slightly outside the CE region, but to Sweden. It's been really noticeable to me that since the kidnapping of Gui Minhai in 2015, opinion in Sweden has really sharpened against China. Look at the opinion polls back in the first half of the last decade. People in Sweden were basically quite positive towards China. And now by a large majority of Swedes are really quite worried about China. They don't like the way the Chinese embassy in Stockholm behaves. They don't like the sort of artificial diplomatic spats. They don't like the pressure that's put on them when the ambassador says, for our friends we have fine wines and for our enemies we have shotguns. That goes down quite badly in Sweden, as one might expect. So I think that China has both failed in its carrots in Eastern Europe, and it's also failed with its sticks. People resent the sticks, but are not scared of them, and they don't find the carrots very tempting. So it's been a pretty poor return on investment For the Chinese Communist Party in Eastern Europe. That doesn't mean that nothing's going on, and there are plenty of things that one can worry about, and the attempt to build long-term connections may eventually bear fruit. But I have been, on the whole, surprised to find out that it was not the way that you might think it was from the headlines. And one final point which I make is about Chinese-Russian cooperation. There's been a lot of talk about how maybe Russia and China are getting close together, and we certainly see cooperation in space. There's the nuclear power contract in China. There's the Vlast-Siberia gas pipeline, various other things. But this seems to me to be highly pragmatic and highly specific. This is not a grand alliance. There's very little sign of sort of real common strategic momentum, either in the context of Shanghai Cooperation Organization or the EAS links with the Belt and Road Initiative. There's just not very much there. Where you might expect to see some friction in Central Asia, for example, with the Chinese territorial claims, the Chinese military, quasi-military base in Tajikistan, and the very strong Chinese energy diplomacy in Turkmenistan and the Chinese activities in Kazakhstan, Russia rather sort of demonstrably says, hands off, we're not going to get involved in that. So there isn't friction where you would expect there to be friction. And there doesn't seem either to be cooperation where one might expect there to be cooperation. So I look forward to your questions. And I should finally say, I'm not a China expert. I know this region that I'm speaking about quite well. And I'm very much aware that the other members of the panel really know stuff about China. And I commend their thoughts in advance to the audience.
Very much, Edward, proving yet again you can be clever, but you don't necessarily have to be very young, to use your own analogy. Ivana, we're going over to you. You're on mute, so looking forward to what you have to say, and welcome to LSE Ideas.
Thank you, Michael, for your kind introduction, and good afternoon or good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be here, of course, with you, and thank you, LSE, for having me. What I would like to do is to focus on the agency of Central and Eastern European countries, because sometimes this region is accused of being on the very reactive side. So CEE is influenced by China, some says CEE is influenced by EU, by Germany, by Russia, by US, you name it. So what I would like to do really is to look at it from the CEE perspective. And I would like to talk mostly about three issues. First, why the CEE countries originally joined the format in 2012. Second, what is the current state? And finally, what may be the future of the format from the CEE perspective? So the motivation of the countries to join was primarily economic. Well, we have to scroll back to 2012, that it was the world after the global financial crisis, and Central and Eastern European countries realized that they are way too dependent, overly dependent on mostly German market, but Western European markets in general. So they were trying to find, diversify the trade routes. And it sort of made sense. So they looked to post-Soviet space, they looked at Russia once again, they looked at China. And from the very beginning, there were these hard-nosed expectations of economic gains. Though some of the political elites may have shown admiration to Chinese authoritarian regime, linked to Budapest and also to President Zeman in the Czech Republic, but these were mostly exceptions, not the rule. And also it was connected to the way how Central and Eastern European countries read international relations. So geopolitically, we are talking about historically really contested region among great powers. First Germany, also Turkey, Soviet Union / Russia, and recently also United States. So Central and Eastern European countries tend to see politics through the prism of size and power of the neighboring countries, and also the risk associated with being neighbors of them. China, on the other hand, was a newcomer, and with its new arrival, CEE felt safely insulated from the immediate effects of its power, not like the neighbors of China in Asia. And there was also some naivety in thinking about China. They thought that this is going to be just another standard Asian investor on par with Japan or South Korea or Taiwan, with which we already had some experience. And last but not least, they also felt that this format, 17+1, or originally 16+1, perhaps now also 16+1, gives them opportunity to meet Chinese counterparts, something they felt Germany or France are getting automatically, while smaller countries they felt were overlooked. So they were quite enthusiastic about joining originally. However, China over the years proved to be a very problematic partner. First, the economic expectations didn't materialize. Then the CEFC company, which came in 2015 and made its headquarters in Prague, it turned out to be based on a Ponzi scheme in 2018. And that also, I would say, inoculated local businessmen against thinking that it may be a good idea to actually cooperate with China and Chinese companies. Edward was talking about some kind of clumsiness in Chinese dealings. That's for sure. But on the other hand, there are also some trends and some things which are worrisome and problematic. And we pointed at these in a report which we published out last year at Choice, which is called Empty Show No More. And then we basically looked beyond just government-to-government relations. We looked at prior diplomacy, so the diplomacy on the level of sub-governmental units. We also looked at dealing on people-to-people diplomacy, so how China is actually trying to influence media, it's trying to influence think tanks, academia. And we also counted into that the increasing warning of counterintelligence agencies, which started to talk about and publish their reports, the open reports, about increasing activities, Chinese activities on our territory. And for some countries, namely Baltic states, the wake-up call came when China joined the military exercise, which was held with Russia in the vicinity of the Baltic states. So all these things, on one hand, some clumsiness, but definitely these, I would say, covert or stealth operations, which were quite well documented actually over the years, led to changing perception of China. And add to that, that China didn't deliver, that the promises didn't actually materialize. And moreover, cooperation with China was connected to a significant reputation loss in the eyes of allies. CEE countries were labeled as sellouts to China, as Trojan horses of China in Europe. And with the changing attitude of US and EU, it started to be very problematic to hold this, let's say, positive account and positive way of dealing with China from CEE perspective. And when they started to actually think about it, really make the hard choices, the CEE countries realized they are caught in security economic dilemma. They are still overly dependent on Germany, still a part of the German supply chains. But on the other hand, Germany is not willing to play the security guarantor of the region. So while Germany is positioning itself to, let's say, being much more accommodative sometimes to China, but also to Russia, for CEE countries, which depend on US protection and security guarantees, it's very difficult to actually find its position within European Union and within NATO and so on, and decide where to fit actually, how to position itself between EU and US/NATO. Well, there is also a difference between EU member states and NATO member states and non-EU member states. So for Western Balkans, China is still quite an interesting opportunity. It's quite an interesting alternative because unlike in CEE countries where the investment came and it was minimal and it came in the form of mergers and acquisitions, some investment actually came into infrastructure projects in Western Balkans. So for Western Balkans, it's still a viable alternative. So as a reaction of all of these mixed things and also changing domestic political landscape, such as seen in countries like Lithuania or Slovakia, which started to be much more cautious or China skeptical, if you feel that, there was also accompanied growing feeling that the format brings many more problems than opportunities. Lithuania this week announced that it's leaving for good. It was hinting it for a couple of weeks already or even months, but now they decided to actually leave with a huge fanfare. The question, of course, is who is going to follow? And seemingly there are no costs attached to that, no sanctions. Edward already mentioned the case of Vystrčil, the Czech Senate president who visited Taiwan last year. We counted it, me and my colleagues, and we came into conclusion that there is actually nothing China can retaliate with. And it's an interesting feature of Central and Eastern European countries, especially EU member states, because they are not overly dependent on China. So there is almost nothing China can retaliate with. We counted that if China decided to stop all the exports to the Czech Republic, if it cuts the raw material and so on, it will have an effect of about 1% of Czech GDP. Well, we can have a debate whether it's a small amount or whether it's a high amount, but definitely it's not drastic. It's not going to lead to Czech Republic basically collapsing economically. So I'm trying to wrap up here. So what it means for the future? I do think that we have already seen very assertive Central and Eastern, especially EU member states in the format. It was seen during this summit, but it was seen also even before, because the countries were pushing quite assertively back on the language which was suggested by China in the final documents. And they realize that they are in this security economic dilemma. They don't want to pick sides, but if they are forced to, they will pick the US. They will pick security over economy. And it might be also an interesting tool for them to actually leverage their influence on China agenda in Brussels. If they play it well, they can actually say, well, you didn't invite us in the table, or we didn't feel that you want us in the table. So if really you want us, let's go for the 27 plus one format, and we will happily leave 17 plus one format. And it may be also an interesting bargaining chip with the US, as they realize that they may actually have been in a very good position to do interesting moves regarding one China policy, for example. And last but not least, we have to mention the big elephant in the room, and that's China. And China is, well, it's, the ball is on China's side currently. So either China will understand how to deal with Central and Eastern European countries and offer them something in real. And here I'm a little bit skeptical and afraid that the CE countries may fall for that once again. Though this time they would be much more cautious. They would have mechanisms to screen investment, for example, than they had before, but they are still interested in the investment. 17 plus one may be repurposed, and it's in CEE countries' interest that they are the ones who are repurposing it, and that's not China. And I will stop here and take whatever you might have in Q&A section. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ivana. Some very interesting observations, and putting Central and Eastern Europe at the center of this, rather having its own agency rather than being something done to it. I think that's very, very important perspective. So thanks for those great comments. And finally, Cherry, over to you to provide your own distinct perspective. I won't have you speaking on behalf of anybody other than yourself, Cherry.
Indeed. Absolutely, not speaking on behalf of any government or institutions in whatever the form, but really delighted to return to LSE Ideas as always. And also, thanks so much for Mick and David and Lucas and Sarah to putting this all together. Really great pleasure. Spent my afternoon at Ideas back. Now, big question, China, Central Eastern European countries collaboration or confrontation or whatever you may call it, I think we shall put in a big picture of this continuous strained relationship between China and United States, as well as continuous worsening relationship with China, as well as the European Unions. I think we shall see continuous ebbs and flows in the next decades to come or so. I think partially is in particularly within the European Union, that seems to be a very strong and hardening view towards China, and precisely because European Unions now intend to make the normative issues such as human rights issues on Xinjiang being the central pillar of its foreign policy towards China, as we have already experienced, you know, given the current freeze of the comprehensive agreement on investment between China and European Union. So that's part of the reason we're expecting to see a somehow even worsening relationship between China and Central Eastern European countries. And also back to 2019, that European Commission has labeled China as being a systemic rebel. Partially is because the European Union realized China by introducing 17 plus one and has really already challenged the already undermined fragile unity of the European Union. Because China, by introducing its way of how economy's been running, by introducing this a certain extending its political influence, and somehow European Union just feel that sense of existential threat from China. So again, put in the bigger context, I think the China and Central Eastern European countries' relations will revolve under this big background. And also for historical reason, that many Central and Eastern European countries are former communist countries. And in natural, I mean, the population within those countries have a sense of natural opposition towards communism, and therefore when it comes to getting closer with China, and perhaps many of the public opinion were hanging a really big question mark, why its leader chose to do so. So I think this is a bigger reason why I would argue that to go further, China and Central Eastern European countries would not be a smooth ride as what we have experienced in the last three or four years or so. Now, secondly, I very much share with the other two speakers' points on the Belt and Road Initiative. Indeed, the Belt and Road Initiative has been launched in the past 8 years or so. It runs highs and lows. But I think for the Central and Eastern European countries that the initial economic incentives to join the BRI has not really been materialized by either by the Chinese government or by the Chinese companies which involved in those projects. So I think that's a really major disappointment for many of those countries sign up the initiative. But on the other hand, what China really wants from the 17 plus one or from the in terms of Belt and Road, it is not just only for investment, but also that sense of endorsement that China could get from many countries, including some of the European members. But however, I think what Chinese misunderstand in here is that really the Central Eastern European countries would have the choice to choose either, for example, European Investment Bank to provide loans, which for those members, for those countries are certainly European members and could offer some beneficiary interest rate to join those infrastructure projects on one hand, whereas on the other hand, choose the Chinese loans and come with a rather opaque and non-transparent terms. So putting this way, I think some of the European members and Central Eastern European countries felt the benefit perhaps to join the club of 17 plus one, it is not so obvious as once it claimed. So that's really the complex picture where we are now. But in addition, what I noticed is also the sense of the vaccine diplomacy that the Chinese government tried to introduce across the region. And obviously you have Serbia, Hungary, and Slovenia and Slovakia all purchased the Sinopharm vaccines. They have seen this as being a necessity rather than somehow embracing the Chinese ideas or Chinese political regime. Because at the end of the day, it should be the European Union throughout its neighborhood policy to offer some dose of those vaccines towards those countries. But the European Union did not offer a single dose being given a minimal support. Therefore, they have turned into Chinese. So I think partially it is also because out of necessity for some of the Central and Eastern European countries turn to Beijing. Lastly, but not least, what are the most important reason I would want to stress in here, to go further, I think the strategic importance of Central and Eastern European countries towards China will be less and less, considering what has been introduced back to March this year, this whole sense of the so-called dual circulation strategy under China's 14th five-year plan. And under that plan, the sense of dual circulation, which is to say that China will have to rely on its production and consumption, its own domestic production and consumption to regenerate the economy. So that's one layer, which is the internal circulation, the internal demand and supply. Now, the second layer is the external circulation, the external demand and supply. And that sense of external circulation, which is to say that China is going to strengthen its partnership, its economic and strategic partnership with many of the Asian Pacific economies in China's near neighbor, and less so in countries afar, such as Eastern European countries and Latin America. So that has really also put China that sense of diplomatic scale back to China's own version of pivot to Asia Pacific. And that really made Central and Eastern European countries become less important. I mean, the previous two speakers have pointed out why China did not really, for example, punishing or imposing sanction, like for example, for those MPs and meeting Taiwanese delegation. I think precisely is because China realized it will have to run through this diplomatic scale back under the age of the great power competition with the United States. Much of the focus will be given to Asia Pacific rather than somewhere quite far away from China. So putting that all together, I think to go further, 17 plus one will have to be moderated one way or another, and it can no longer really just continue as what China wishes to do. And perhaps in order to make the initiative more constructive, perhaps China would consider that by building infrastructure, it is not really just a panacea to resolve all the development issues that many of the Central Eastern European countries want and need. And China should really have to take care and look into what are those countries really needed from China and whether China will be able to provide it or not. In order to answer that question, I think China would have a long way to go. And also for the Belt and Road Initiative in a few years to come, again, it will be a more scaled back operation rather than something across different continents. So put all of this in the context, I think 17 plus one in terms of priorities for China will become less and less. And therefore perhaps the conflicts or the competition between China and the EU on this region will gradually phase out. So I ended in here and much look forward to hear your comments and questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Cherry, for a nice objective perspective. I'm going to come in with maybe a question for each of you, or anybody can pick it up. First question really to Edward, if I might, Edward. Can one de-link politics from economics? It could well be that China has missed the trick in Central and Eastern Europe for the reasons that you've given, and I wouldn't entirely demur from that. On the other hand, Central Eastern Europe has not gained very much either, and they could have gained a great deal more than they have gained, it seems to me, from what I'm reading and what I hear you saying. Is there any way that one can de-link the geopolitical, the political from the economic? And if one doesn't do so, where does this therefore leave the future of the relationship with China, not only, I suppose, in Central and Eastern Europe, but between the West and China? Because it does seem that you wrote about a new Cold War back in 2008 and you meant Russia. It seems to me that in 2021, that concept should also be now extended to China's relationship with the West. Large question, broad question, no straightforward answer, I know, Edward. But would like to get your general reflections on that, please.
Yes, I mean, I think you can depoliticize economic relations once you have a political context for it. So in the European Union, for example, the Netherlands is a major gas exporter to Germany, but it doesn't try and weaponize its gas exports the way that Russia does. And if the Netherlands decided they need to build a pipeline to Germany, no one would fuss about it the way that people worry about Nord Stream 2, the pipeline across the Baltic Sea. So I think that if in another world, imagine a parallel universe in which China had decided to stick with the hide and bide policy. All they're concentrating on is fast economic growth and slow political liberalization. And you put the clock back to pre-Xi Jinping. Mm. And in those circumstances, I think you might have had quite a lot of East European countries saying that it makes sense to build trade relations and investment with China as part of diversification. You don't want more than 10% of your foreign trade to go with Russia, but up to 10% of your foreign trade with China would be fine. That would just be a kind of, and particularly for countries a bit further east, I'm talking more of the sort of Ukrainians, Georgians, countries in that region where they may think that we're never going to get quick, deep integration with Western markets. So yes, a balanced portfolio would make sense. So that could have happened, and you could have had situations where, the Chinese would have bought a big Ukrainian aircraft company like Motorsikh, and nobody would have minded about it because American-Chinese relations are quite good, and they'd have said, fine, that's all. Main thing is it shouldn't go to the Russians. So that could have happened, but it categorically hasn't. Mm. And I think that on the infrastructure side, there was a kind of myth that China is really, really good at building infrastructure, and there's some kind of magic formula where involving cheap Chinese money and highly effective Chinese civil engineering, which will magically build infrastructure projects which will otherwise not get built. And that again, that was, you know, a nice idea, but it failed in Poland with the motorway. In Poland, it's failed with the railway. It's failed with the road in Montenegro. It turns out that Chinese infrastructure projects are actually quite expensive. The money isn't free. They don't go particularly fast. You've got maybe one example of success, which is the Plesac bridge in Croatia. But that's a pretty, you know, I think anyone in the region now thinking we need some big infrastructure done would think really twice or three times or four times about saying, let's go to the Chinese for it. But I think that the big point is I just wanted to pick up, which is what Terry was saying earlier, is that China's successes, insofar as there are successes, always have one factor in it, which is Western failure. You have a country where the West's influence, for whatever reason, is weak, where we failed to engage the elite, we've failed to offer a perspective for public opinion, and that's where China does well. So Western Balkans, the neglected backyard of the European Union, it looks much more convincing there that China has something to offer. Not, I mean, vaccine diplomacy now, but other things as well. But in the country, and I think it's no coincidence that the countries that have been most resistant to Chinese pressure are the ones that are perhaps the biggest, you know, from a Euro-Atlantic, you know, NATO-EU point of view, the biggest success stories like the Baltics.
Thanks very much. Ivana, I want to come to you really and follow up on that. Has China simply not got the economic wherewithal, have the kind of relationship that some believed it might have back in 2012, 13, 14? In other words, the Belt and Road, I think Cherry's written about this too, it wasn't exactly a Potemkin village, but there was much hype about the Belt and Road, which was never going to be delivered for purely economic reasons. Or is it that China's overplayed its hand? I mean, it strikes me, and I kind of look at this from an international relations point of view, as much as a regional one, which you do, that all great powers tend to overreach. It's an old thesis of great powers. And I just wondered whether or not you think China thought it had become far more influential than it really was after the 2008 crisis. It thought America was in decline. It thought it was on a roll, a new president, and they overplayed their hand with the kind of negative consequences that both you and Edward in particular have talked about. What do you think has been driving China? I know you want to talk about Central Eastern Europe, but from your analytical expertise, what do you think has been driving China, therefore, to make what looks like a series of major miscalculations of overreach? Ivana, over to you.
Of course, I like to talk about Central and Eastern Europe, but I don't have any problem talking about China
either. No, I know.
Well, basically my observation, I'm not going to prove it or to base it on anything else than my, let's say, you know, analytical feeling and gut, is that China basically thought that CEE is a low-hanging fruit, that it would have to be successful because these are post-communist countries. China sees to itself as a post-communist kind of as well at another stage. It didn't have really the expertise to deal with Central and Eastern European countries. It pulled them into the one simple basket, didn't take into account that Baltic states are very different than Western Balkans, that Czech Republic is very different than Hungary, Hungary is very different than Poland, and so on. Plus, they didn't understand the language. So these were, there were social, demographic, or social language boundaries from the very beginning. And then they basically didn't understand why they are not liked. They entered the region, which was not feeling very well being identified as post-communist. It was something which originally Baltic states were felt very weird about, that why we are in the same basket as I don't know, Serbia or Montenegro. They basically did it, but what was quite an interesting phenomena or aspect of that was that they actually started to inject this kind of regional identity on Central and Eastern European countries. So the countries which didn't feel that they have something in common at the very beginning started to feel that they do have something in common, and it's China. But here I'm on Central and Eastern European side again, so back to China. So what I'm thinking actually is that China got overconfident with Xi Jinping. And I do think that this whole abandonment of let's keep low profile policy, which was allegedly attributed to Deng Xiaoping, that it was a mistake, that it basically overcalculated, that it calculated, as you said, that the US is in decline, that this is a really good time for China to stop hiding its strength and to come up as the world leader. But they overcalculated because they didn't have capacities, they didn't have the knowledge, and the US is still there and kicking very much. So
it may seem the fate of all great powers to do the same. I think it may not be specifically a China problem. Cherry, do you want to pick up on that one? Because you are, as we all know, a great China specialist, as indeed is Ivana, but Ivana wants to focus more on the central. But thank you for those comments, Ivana. What do you think, Cherry? I mean, to me, it's still a mystery. You and I taught at Beidou, Peking University, in the early days, we might say the easier days. Hu Jintao was president, and clearly things have changed a lot since then. What's your own thoughts on that too, Cherry, about has China miscalculated, or do they feel they've simply done what all great powers have done, is actually assert their interest, and nobody in the West is prepared to deal with China as an equal, which of course is the China view? What's your own line on that, Cherry?
Couple of reasons in here. I think first reason is this whole idea of looking for endorsement, as I said earlier, you know, seeking the endorsement from European countries, from many countries around the world for any initiative that China put forward to, you know, that try to prove itself by being a great power. And therefore, you do need followers and seeking endorsement. And therefore, they thought perhaps Central Eastern European countries is easier target to go forward to by providing certain financial assistance, which European Union perhaps not able to do so. So I think that's a part of the reason why China even perhaps overstretched towards the Central and Eastern European countries. That's reason number one. And the reason number two, I think, is this lack of sophisticated diplomatic skills when it comes to dealing with countries that the language skill, I mean, Ivana mentioned earlier, you know, the language and also demography in China was not really familiar with, but going through all these different countries and just make sure it followed this so-called political order and being politically correct of sign up Belt and Road Initiative. So I think there's also a reason of lack of sophisticated diplomatic skill. I think third reason, there's also very crucial and domestic political reason that both diplomats and Chinese state-owned enterprises would like to show loyalty to its president and to the party. And therefore they have to follow whatever the initiative bring forward by the central government. So I think these are three reasons added together and perhaps now become a sense of dangerous cocktail for China to either to be able to drink it or not. I mean, we don't know.
I think also, as Ivana pointed out, the importance of the 2008 crisis.
Well, I mean, there's a difference.
I think Central Eastern Europe read it as a way of lessening our dependency on say, the United States or Europe.
I mean, actually, I was quite stuck by this. Just judging by the latest speech made by Xi Jinping in January earlier this year, and you know, much of the Western media really covered by saying this whole idea of East is rise and the West is in decline has been widely circulated in Western media. But actually, the second half of the sentence is that China experienced the unprecedented challenge in the and have not seen in the last 100 years. And clearly, the central leadership now is aware that China is still a sizable difference from the world number one power. So I'm expecting a diplomatic scale back from Beijing in the years to come.
Well, as you know, I've always argued that I think there's been a statement and an overstretch in the analysis in the West, exemplified in a book which I think said in 2008, the same year as yours, Edward, that China was about to rule the world or would be ruling the world. I think there's also been kind of misperception. I don't know, this is my own take on it. Can I ask you a question, Edward, or maybe Ivana too? Why 16? I mean, you already had a Visegrad 4. Why not go for 4? The whole idea of getting 16 strikes me as massively overambitious. I mean, who came up with 16 rather than 4 or 5? Was there any reason for that? Edward or Ivana? It's a complete mystery to me. Edward, go or Ivana?
I'll let Ivana answer that, but I want to answer a related question.
Sure, please.
Which is that I'd be a bit cautious about saying that all Chinese diplomats in the region are completely cloth-eared and ignorant. Because I've come across Chinese foreign ministry officials and diplomats, and I think the Chinese ambassador to Bosnia, who I haven't met, speaks really first-rate Bosnian. Which in previous life was probably known as Serbo-Croat, but he certainly speaks it very well. And I've met Chinese who speak specialists in Ukraine who speak Ukrainian really well, and I've met Chinese Polish specialists who speak really good Polish. So I think yeah. in a big country like China, you will have people. I think it may be more that the people who know the language and the culture aren't given a decision-making role, which is not a unique problem to China. It also, even dare I say, it happens in the British Foreign Office and similar places. The other thing I just want to say is that there's a bit of a pushback which we haven't mentioned, which is that the foreign minister, but the Chinese Communist Party's foreign policy chief visited Slovenia and Croatia this week following on his visit to Moscow, and the Slovenes, Croatians, Poles and Irish are all going to Beijing, and I want to highlight the significance there of the Poles. And I think the Poles are very miffed with America at the moment, and have not been taking part in the sort of general anti-Beijing drumbeat of the past few months. And I think that there, possibly Poland is now demonstrating it's got options other than America, and just flirting a teeny weeny bit with Beijing, which is possibly an unwise move. But again, it highlights the role that China has as being the place you go to for sort of performative diplomacy.
Could I just add something else there about the quality of Chinese, not Chinese diplomats, but Chinese students as well? Many have come and done work at LSE on a strategy course that I've been teaching for the last year. I have to say, I've been pretty impressed, both by their knowledge of the world and more generally their open-mindedness, in most cases, not in all. So I think you're right to actually stress that. Ivana, can you tell me why we've got 16 rather than the 4?
Yeah, I can, but I would like to react on what Edward said.
Please do, yeah, that'd be great. That's what I want to.
The thing is that I think that China at the very beginning didn't really pay that much attention to CE countries, and we have seen, you know, clumsy diplomats or not the best rating diplomats in Central and Eastern European countries showing how little interest actually China showed to that. But there are differences, there are changes in that. So the most important countries like Poland, like Romania, the bigger countries are getting better stuff. But the Czech Republic, I would still argue that's, but perhaps the Czech Republic is a very difficult country. Perhaps they think in Beijing that whatever they do, we will not like China anyway. So that's maybe the reason why we are stuck with a person who, if you have three different options, he definitely goes for the worst one. So at least there is some consistency, I have to admit to that. Second, why we have 17 plus one. Well, that's kind of a mystery. My reading of that is that somebody basically looked at a map and thought that this is, you know, free land. This is the land of no one. This is the land between Western Europe and between Russian sphere of influence. And if you think about it, they very carefully avoided countries like Georgia, Armenia, countries which would make sense from the infrastructure point of view, but they didn't want to step on Russia's foot. So, and the reasoning that these are post-communist countries, with Greece joining 17 plus one, it doesn't make any sense anymore. So I don't think that there was this reasoning of post-communist countries only. It was mostly geopolitically defined area of the land of no one, which could be taken. And last but not least, I would like to react on what Cherry said, that some of these countries are turning to China out of necessity, or to Russia out of necessity. Well, yeah, it's true for some extent, but on the other hand, this denies the Western Balkans, for example, the agency once again. And I would like to keep the agency of Central and Eastern Europe here at the central point. How I do see that some of the countries are reacting, and namely Serbia or Hungary, I would label it as a signal diplomacy, if I would like to be kind, or blackmailing of Europe, if I want to be quite bold. Because what I do see is that both Hungary and Serbia, their main interest really lie in European Union or in accession to European Union. That's where the most funds are coming from, even if you combine what came from Russia and from China. EU is still exceeding that in both cases, in Serbia and in Hungary. So they go to Brussels and they come with demands. And one of my colleagues calls this peacock diplomacy. So they go to Brussels, show the feathers. Then they go to Moscow, show the feathers, the Beijing, show the feathers. And by going to Moscow and Beijing, they scare Brussels. Mm. And Brussels is willing to offer. Otherwise, perhaps they may run to Russia or China. So we have to somehow stop criticizing Orbán's regime, or we have to increase the funds which are flowing to Serbia. And last but not least, what I would like to mention here is that I do think that EU is sometimes lacking in strategic communication, that it would be better if they get better in this, in publicizing how much money went to Serbia, for example, in medical aid over the years, that would far exceed what China has been providing during the coronavirus crisis. So it would be great to get the facts straight and also to publicize them from the EU side.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. I've often argued that the EU should do more boasting. You know, stop hiding their bushel under, you know, stop being so modest. And I think, you know, a few facts on the ground would certainly help the situation. I've got a question that's come in, and I think this one might be designed for you, Ivana, which is on COVID diplomacy. We're about to get it. I know you've just written about this. What does it add up to in terms of China? Comes back to your point. The other thing is, what impact has the perception of China, let me put it bluntly, being successful in dealing with the pandemic, whatever the origins of it are, and they're going to be disputed forever, I imagine. What impact does Chinese success in dealing with the pandemic, what impact that had on Central Eastern Europe compared, say, to how, let's be blunt, how President Trump handled or mishandled? Has that had any impact on public opinion in Central and Eastern Europe? And maybe you want to come in on that, Edward, and I've got another question for Cherry in 1 second. Ivana, why don't you come back on that one, please?
It's actually the other way around, but I would probably leave US out of the picture because I haven't seen any study done on deterioration or increase of popularity on US in Central and Eastern Europe. But I did see a poll, survey, which was done in 13 countries, which was done by colleagues in Sinophone borderlands in Czech Republic and also in Slovakia. Mm. On that, and it showed that the views of Central and Eastern European countries deteriorating over the coronavirus pandemic. So what has an effect was not the fact that China managed the coronavirus crisis well. What had an effect was the origin of coronavirus crisis.
Okay. So,
and that's it's not even disputed here in Central and Eastern Europe. Yes, some French media outlets do that. Yes, there are conspiracy theories flying around, but not in the mainstream. So that's really had a huge negative impact on China's image in Central and Eastern Europe.
So the focus is on the origin, not on where China has gone from there. Edward, do you want to come in on that particular question before I move on?
I think people remember the way stories end more than the way that they begin. And I think that it took some time for the EU to get into gear. And during that time, both Russia and China made real headway. It was very spectacular, particularly in Italy, where my wife comes from. The feeling that Italy was left in the lurch by the Germans, and the EU solidarity really let down countries to the south and east. And so they had some successes there, and you know, Sputnik, Sinopharm. But I don't think in the greater scheme of things it's a game changer. I think that the real question is, which do people mind about more? Is it the anti-Americanism and the distaste for American leadership, which is really there in France and Germany and some other countries, and the feeling we don't want to be dragged into some kind of new Cold War by the Americans against China, versus the feeling of being scared and disgusted about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to? So on the one hand, people think, gosh, look at Xinjiang, East Turkestan, if you prefer, the crackdown in Hong Kong, they treat their own people like that, how are they going to treat us? It's all pretty, we don't like it, scary. So maybe in the end, we better be in with the Americans versus why are we being bossed around? I think that's the real inflection, and that can go either way. as far as the so-called Eastern Europe is concerned, I must say I hate the term Eastern Europe, and I try never to use it. But I think countries that have that are particularly dependent on the United States for security, which is the Baltics and the Nordics, but also to some extent Romania, very strongly Atlanticist, and they're sort of particularly going to be willing to follow Washington's lead on things like 5G and Huawei. But actually, every country is going down that route. I mean, I think in the end, Huawei is going to be kicked out of 5G networks all across Europe. It's some countries are faster than others, but even Hungary, I suspect, in the end, is going to say to Huawei, "Sorry, we can't be a Huawei island in a sea of non-Huawei." So I think in the end, I mean, there's always a lot of huffing and puffing, but in the end, Europe is dependent on the United States security, and in the end, it will take the American lead. If America wants a sort of binary choice of our way or the Chinese way, then Europe will basically go the American way.
Yeah, I think that's right. Cherry, I want to come in. I've got a question. That, by the way, was a question from Ewan Grant. Thanks, Ewan, for that. That's great. It's a question from Costas. In terms of what's been going on in Central Europe, I'll call it Central Europe now and leave out the E I don't mind either. What's been going on in Central Europe, do the countries of the Western part of the EU now feel far more relaxed about what has been happening? Because at the beginning, or at least by 2013, 14, it looked they were getting very, very worried, divide and rule. It seems now they may be a lot more relaxed about this situation. Ivana, maybe you could pick up on that. And I'll also bring in Cherry to think where China now views this relationship going forward, because we've half answered that, but I want a bit more on that. So, Ivana, how does this impact it back on, say, countries like on the EU in Brussels? And do they now feel a lot more relaxed, whereas a few years ago they weren't?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I think that what we do see here in Western Europe is increased panic over it with China. There were always political players or countries which were very concerned with human rights issues and so on, but nothing really changed this until to the point when Germany particularly got scared with China buying into its companies and buying and overtaking the supply chains. And that was the turning point. And I would like to see the 17 plus one as a in a broader picture. And I do see, especially Germany, toughening up, but on the other hand, still trying to leverage and still trying to have a better access to Chinese market on the other hand. So what I do think here is happening is that there is an increased panic in Western Europe and more willingness to see 17 plus one as a problem rather than being relaxed and saying, oh, okay, Lithuania is leaving, so that means that the format is going to collapse.
That's very interesting. Cherry, do you want to come in on that at all?
Absolutely. Yeah, just to for additional information, the current Chinese ambassador Chek is actually a LSE alumni. So,
oh my goodness me.
just for reference here. I mean, I'm not talking down the Chinese diplomats in here at all. Actually, I respect them a lot because I know they have incredibly difficult job to do, not just for foreign audience, but more importantly, for the domestic audience back to Beijing. So apart from that, I mean, on the future trajectory of EU-China relations, I'm afraid I can't really bring much optimism, because one thing which we haven't mentioned in here is this American factor, you know, the return of the so-called alliances, the return of the transatlantic coordination towards China. And we're going to hear this rhetoric from Biden administration more and more so. So I think part of the reason why this current discussion on the comprehensive agreement on investment being stalled by the European Parliament is precisely because the Europeans are now considering the American factor and perhaps would find the ways and means to dealing with China, the so-called China challenge with Washington, even more so than somehow with a cool economic head to calculate the benefit and by getting closer with Beijing. So I think we're going to experiencing more turbulent EU-China relations also. Whether this would change, I think unlikely, considering that Germany is going to having this chancellor election in September. Perhaps Germany will also switch more towards harsher foreign policy towards China, and so as do many other major Western European states. I mean, as we have experienced in UK as well. So I see this a trend of somehow felt that the China's economic benefit alone is no longer sufficient by treating China as being a credible diplomatic partner to work together. So that's where the problem, I think the problem is really putting the bigger picture that China-US relations getting deteriorated so badly, and therefore everything else is revolving around that deterioration.
Yeah, I think that's great because I mean, absolutely correctly, it wants to bring Central Europe back in as agent in its own right, and I think that's quite right. And as a student of Central Eastern Europe since the Versailles Peace Treaty, my general view is that great powers in general have been pretty awful when it's come to Central and Eastern Europe, going back to the Versailles Peace Treaty. But that's a much longer historical question we should debate, Ivana. Hold on a minute, let me just finish. So if we can then ask the question about where, therefore, does this leave Central Europe? I mean, it goes back, therefore, to where it was back in 2008, or have things so changed as a result, even of a what you might call a failure, that we're now in a different world altogether, and you can't just go back to 2008. Has it damaged relations with the Western countries of the EU or the United States or not? What do you think? Or maybe, Edward, you want to come in on that as well, but I'll start with Ivana if you want. Ivana, please.
I don't think that it damaged relations with Western Europe, and I don't even think that we are back in 2008, because this whole experience with China is very important for Central and Eastern European countries. Like, fool me once, but not twice. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very good for the local populations also to see and to understand better China, because at the square one, at the very beginning, Central and Eastern Europe didn't know who they are dealing with. So there was a lot of, you know, mystic and a lot of fascination with the great market, big market of 1.3 billion consumers just waiting for our goods and so on. So now I do see the debates much more detailed, much more informed, and much more, I would say, mature, even in Central and Eastern European countries. And that's quite a good development. And I do also think that Central and Eastern Europe have something to offer to the rest of European Union. This particular experience of dealing with China, and not only the fact how to deal with China in 17+1 format, where you have countries such as Hungary that have a very different view than the rest of members of the EU, but also the experience with researching China, because I would argue that we are not so bad, that we are actually on a comparative level with Western Europe when it comes to China studies, when it comes to analysis of Chinese influence or Chinese demonstration of Chinese power. And that may be a valuable asset as well. So I don't think that we are somehow damaged goods in this.
No, I wasn't implying that.
Can I jump in on that?
Yeah, please do, Edward.
Ivana is far too modest here. I think this has been a tremendous opportunity for particularly the Czech Republic and Lithuania have shown real leadership and real geopolitical savvy. I think that this particular visit to Taiwan it'll be a paragraph in the history books. That was the time, I think, when the tide turned and the relentless attempt by the party state in Beijing to marginalize Taiwan finally got its first serious pushback, and it made it a lot easier for other countries to do it. And I think that Lithuania's stance as well has shown, you know, it's a country of 3 million people, and they are leading the charge not only when it comes to Chinese influence operations in the 17+1, but also as it happens on Belarus as well. So I think that it's given, and Ivana is far too modest, the capabilities, the China watching capabilities in Central and Eastern Europe are really impressive. Synopsis is a world class source of analysis of what's going on, and I'm stunned. I don't want to be too mean about Britain and America, but I mean, some of our think tanks possibly have got a bit too close to Chinese money and have got a bit too nervous about doing things that might offend the Chinese Communist Party, and think tanks in parts of the world that are not untouched by Chinese money, or indeed untouched by any money at all, but are managing to do a really good job in analysing United Front Work Department approaches and so on. So I think it's hats off to our colleagues in this part of the world. And almost as with Russia, we need to sort of learn a bit both on the kind of moral clarity and on the analytical depth.
Yeah, thanks for those comments. We can talk about think tanks more generally. I can assure you the LSE Ideas gets no money straight away.
Yes,
even more money from somewhere. But maybe you'd like to donate a little bit, Edward. We'd be more than welcome. Cherry, do you want to come in? Because you had your hand up earlier on, you wanted to come in on something.
Sure. I mean, just to adding, the further trajectory, when you ask me the trajectory of the Western Europe and China, I think it's part of the reason is also because the Chinese economy itself has changed. Because in the past few years, since China joined WTO, up until the 2008 financial crisis, and China is really very much in the catching up curve, by treating the European companies or European government as a way of teaching China how to do things, how to modernize corporate governance, how to make itself competitive. But nowadays, what we have the situation that both Chinese companies and European companies become effective competitors at the Chinese domestic market, but as well as many other global markets. So I think it's because of the nature that the Chinese economy has evolved, and then somehow putting this bilateral relations between China and the European Union getting very strained. So I think that's a part of reason we should take into account is China itself has evolved, and therefore the relationship can no longer really like what happened in the past. Like yesterday when Campbell was talking about China-US engagement and the period is now over. I mean, we can all agree it is indeed over. And partially it's because China itself, the nature of economy, how it has been run has changed.
That's interesting. I've got a number of questions, and I've been trying to filter them through in different ways to the three of you to give you all equal voice in this. But I'm bound to ask a Brexit question. I'm sorry about that. I try, because it's come up and it's been asked by one of our colleagues here, Waqar Ahmed. Thank you, Waqar. How far do you think, and I'll have to start with you, Edward, on this, if you don't mind, but then move on. How far do you think Brexit has weakened the European Union and by associations therefore weakened the Europeans' ability to deal with either Russia or China? I'll throw in Russia because I think it's...
I think the problem is that the European Union doesn't have qualified majority voting when it comes to foreign policy. And the Hungarians have twice recently vetoed sanctions on Hong Kong, and they are relating to Hong Kong, and they've also earlier vetoed a common statement on human rights. Yeah. I don't think that changes. I mean, it's just possible that if Britain was still in, somehow we would use our sort of magic key with Orban to get him to back down. But I think that's pretty unlikely. So I think there's a fundamental problem with EU foreign policy, and actually also with EU defence policy. With EU foreign policy, that you need unanimity, and for EU defence policy, you need money, and there's no money, and there's no unanimity. And apart from that, it works beautifully. I don't share the view that it was a great constraint on Britain. It seems to me that France, Germany, and Britain all maintain their own China policies, and indeed their own Russia policies, and do so unbothered by whatever the EU is or is not doing. And we see both France sending its navy to the South China Sea and actually regularly transiting the Taiwan Strait, which is more than some other countries are willing to do, and Germany also sending a frigate, then getting cold feet and saying it has to go to have a port visit in China first and ask permission nicely before it does any phone ops, which was the main point of going. And of course, we see the British, the largest British task force since Dunkirk or whatever it is, going off there to going off to South China Sea. So I don't really think it makes a difference. I think that where the EU is weakened by Brexit is in terms of its economic negotiating clout. And if one was trying to stitch together transatlantic economic governance and sort of redo TTIP, and TTIP was fundamentally an attempt to constrain China, if we were redoing TTIP, it would be a complication that Britain wasn't in the EU, because Britain would have pushed for TTIP as an EU member, and TTIP and the arrangement would have been more elegant if it had included Britain. So I think that that's a problem, and we are in a difficult world now trying to do these trans-Pacific and transatlantic economic governance arrangements in it, when the air's gone out of the balloon as far as free trade is concerned. So it's a complicating factor, but I don't think it's fundamentally, if the political will was there, we would overcome these things. And if the political will isn't there, Brexit doesn't make any difference.
Can I bring you in, Ivana, and just bounce off that point as well? We had a session not very long ago with LSE Ideas looking at the Visegrad countries. Very fascinating discussion that it was too. Through our Central East, Southeast European program, the RATU Forum, coming out of Romania. But I got the impression, talking to friends there in the four Visegrad countries, a kind of sense of loss about Britain leaving the European Union, perhaps maybe more strongly felt than some other countries in the European Union. I don't know. What could you give me some sense from where you're sitting or about the perceptions of Brexit and how that's impacted on how you feel about
The thing is, I'm coming in from a country which is now the most skeptical on EU after Brexit. So you left and we are still there. So it's quite difficult to comment on that. But what I think is, I would probably frame it in a way that what the Visegrad countries probably miss with the Brexit is that France is still there. So, I mean, it may be a very dangerous combo to have Germany and France without the third party, without someone moderating a big party, which will be Atlanticist. So that was probably the concern of Visegrad countries. Probably not all of them, but at least three of them.
Also, the UK was one of the stronger advocates of enlargement, of course, going back a long time ago. Again, some resistance from other countries that you've already mentioned. I want to kind of bring in Russia and China, if I could, Edward. I've read your article, the piece you did with Bobo Lowe, an old colleague and friend of mine, with whom I polemicized on this particular question. But I noticed that one of the comments you made, Ivan, if I pick it up, that one of the things that worried, got people more worried in Central Europe and in your part of the world, was when there was a joint military operation, if I understood you correctly, I can't remember the precise year, between Russia on the one hand and the People's Republic of China on the other. And that started to worry people more than some of the other things, or in addition to the other things.
I wouldn't say it's worrying.
I think Ivana took that view. That's what I'm trying to say, Edward, not you, I know.
Yeah, right. Well, I think it's true. I mean, there are military ties. We've seen Chinese troops in the Russian Far East, for example.
Yeah.
Although whether that was mainly to show them that Russia's serious about defending the Russian Far East rather than anything cooperative. And there's been some joint stuff in Central Asia as well, as on an SCO basis. But again, and that's more about sort of saying to the Americans, don't think that you can be in here like the way you were 20 years ago.
Yeah.
In terms of the in the Baltic, we saw Chinese warships in the Baltic, I think 2017. And that was interesting because they hadn't been seen there before. But obviously they're a long way from home, and it's not really a projection of power, it's a flying the flag. And we are, I understand, and this hasn't been announced yet, but I think it's pretty certain, we're going to see a Chinese element in the ZAPAD, which is the quadrennial Russian, Belarusian joint exercises, which will take place in September, and there'll be a Chinese presence there. So I think I'm sure it's useful for the Chinese from an intelligence point of view. They get to find stuff out, and yeah, it's always good for soldiers to go to the other side of the world and exercise. So it's not valueless from their point of view. And it will be interesting for the Russians and the Belarusians. I think it signals to the West that there is a bit of, I wouldn't say strategic depth, but there's a bit of diplomatic depth to what's going on. It perhaps also signals the Belarusians, you think you're friends with China, we're much bigger friends with China, actually. So it's kind of interesting, but you know, in terms of projection of power, what China is really good at is hacking. You know, I'm far more worried about the data collection at Liège Airport, and the data collection in railway stations and other transport hubs, where they're getting your mobile phone, your biometric data, your face, the way you walk, stuff like that, probably getting your passport data, sticking all that together and putting it in a big database where they start working out who you know and what you do with it. This is the stuff that ASPIC has looked at in Australia. And this is a really major, you know, a billion plus people in databases of outside China, in databases in China, being sliced and diced and worked on. That's serious. The other thing that I think is really serious is the hegemonic discourse control in Western universities. What's going on in up the road in Cambridge, for example. I was just messaged today by a lecturer at Cambridge who's been told by the authorities there, please stay off this topic. It's bad for business. He lectures on something which is quite sensitive from the Chinese point of view. He has some points the Chinese don't like, and Cambridge is trying to keep him quiet. And we see harassment on campus, people being, this is really serious. I'm far more worried about that than I am about few Chinese planes or boots on the ground or ships.
So it's the new security you're more worried about than the old type of security. Ivana, can you come back on that question, because I'm struck by the point you made anyway. If you could,
I wanted to frame it, or to repeat perhaps the point. The point
Please,
was
yeah.
that for Baltic countries, the fact that China and Russia held a joint military exercise in the vicinity of Baltic countries was the wake-up call for them. And it was the first year when, for example, Latvian counterintelligence agency added Chinese activities for the very first time on par with China, with Russian activities in the country. So they started to pay much more attention to China alongside Russia. But to put it on a broader context, Central and Eastern Europe is not discussing China on a daily basis. It's not a priority. For Central and Eastern Europe, the priority is EU, it's US, then a NATO, then Russia, and then somewhere on the list is China. But Russia is far bigger threat, or felt as a far bigger threat. And it was the first time when China was actually seen in a very similar lenses, that these two may actually cooperate.
I've written on this, and I'll communicate with Edward. We'll have a discussion about that. It's separate. Maybe Cherry, you could come in on that one as well, on the China-Russia relationship. I know you and you've written about this, you've thought about this, and I've written about this. Maybe I've got it right, maybe I've got it wrong. And how do you think that impacts on the issues that we're discussing today?
Really less so. Really, what Russia can offer, I mean, what China really after is a global leadership. Whereas Russia remains as a secondary regional power in Northeast Asia. So China has a bigger agenda of the so-called shaping the global governance and projecting discursive power, you know, the ability to shaping the international big debate from the very beginning. And that is not something that Russia can offer out of this so-called strategic comprehensive partnership. So I think the relationship will remain very high on rhetoric, and perhaps you will see a collaborations from here and there. But really, when it comes to substance, how much Russia can really bring Beijing to giving some kind of additional benefit when it comes to boosting Beijing's so-called global leadership, I think Russia can offer very little. And also the two countries and see the world, how the world should be organized very differently. I mean, China sees the world should really be organized and the views of integrate itself into the global economy, whereas Russia is the greatest disruptor of the geopolitics. So I think the two countries essentially taking different worldview. I would really say diplomatic relationship, they remain on very high rhetoric, but when it comes to substance, there's a very little.
Yeah, thanks very much, Cherry. Again, that's a debate ongoing, as you know. I'm going to come back to Ivana again, if I could. If Edward is still there, I just see a picture rather than Edward. But I'm going to come back to, well, I can talk to a picture, but it looks a bit strange. I'll come back to Ivana straight away. Ivana, you mentioned there, and this point has been come up in the questions, about Euroscepticism. It's an old-fashioned word now. I think it's overdone, possibly. Euroscepticism is not the same as making a decision, however, to leave the European Union. And what, again, as somebody who follows the events in Central Europe without being a full expert, obviously, like yourself, I kind of think you can talk the Eurosceptical game, but at the end of the day, even Hungary under Orban, you know, that doesn't look to me as if he's going to make any move to get out. So you get all the benefits of being a Eurosceptic politically, not you personally, but still all the benefits of being a member of the European Union. Do you want to kind of come back on that one, Ilana, before everybody comes back again?
I absolutely agree. I think that even the governing party, which of Prime Minister Babiš, who is now criticized by his interesting use of funds from EU to support his own business, even this party is not willing to or is not advocating for leaving EU. But on the other hand, we are going to have elections in October. And anything can happen. The coronavirus pandemic basically rocked the boat a lot. So any party can get into not only parliament, but also the government. And we do have extreme parties here, either left-wing or right-wing parties, actually, who are advocating for leaving EU. And it may be that we will basically leave by an accident, but by the fact that Prime Minister, whoever that would be, may feel that he would need the support of this junior partner and may ask for the referendum. And that was very much advocated by these extreme parties that the referendum should be run on this issue. And I'm not quite sure how that would end with the referendum, because the parties may be sensible in the end, but the local population, if it is a public referendum, I'm less convinced that I can predict actually the outcome of this.
Well, I can reassure you, Ivana, and you know this better from the UK. I know from the UK perspective, we never thought the UK was going to, well, many of us never thought the UK would leave the European Union, or at least suspected it wasn't ever going to happen. I mean, June 2016 was a shock, in the same way, I suppose, that some people would regard the Trump election in November as a shock, unexpected, at least by the experts. But what you bring to the table, I think, is a very important point. You know, the people will decide, and if they decide, they might not decide in the way that liberal elites or university professors like me might prefer them to go. And that's a very interesting perspective. And I think from my point of view, at least, a somewhat worrying one if that were to happen. Can I widen the debate out to China and the European Union in the totality, if you don't mind me doing that? Where do we think today, in the light of everything that's been said, where do we think China-EU relationships in the totality now are? Maybe I'll start with you, Cherry, because I know you wrote your PhD on that a few years ago. I won't say many, many years ago. It makes you sound far too old. Where do you think it now sits, Cherry, in terms of where you started writing about this a few years ago, I remember in your doctoral work? Where do you think it is now, and how important is it to China? We might say that the CEE countries are maybe less important, but certainly Europe, the EU is still vitally important. But where is that relationship now, do you think, in the totality of that, Cherry? Just to start with you, and maybe then move on to Edward and then back to...
Sure. I think there's some... It's quite interesting. It's not really like what I call a linear decline, but I would say it comes with ebbs and flows, that China has a really high hope towards the European Union could become really substantial pillar in terms of counterbalancing United States. And obviously China did not really have that expectation met, and therefore on its expectation towards European Union, it come quite low those days. It would remain as a very strong economic partner, but if you ask me how much real economic benefit that European Union can bring by having this comprehensive agreement on investment towards China, towards the Chinese GDP number, I think it's virtually zero. So to having Europeans on the Chinese side on certain subjects, you know, climate change, on those global common issues are very important. But I think the Chinese are very much gearing up now to entering a period of protracted conflict with the United States. So European Union is part of this calculation, but it's not entire calculation. And China was much hoping that EU could stay on the neutral term in this confrontation with the United States. But that neutral term, perhaps, again, China will be disappointed.
Okay, that's very interesting. Edward, you're, are you still walking or are you with us at the moment?
Sorry, I had to go. It's a very good question. I won't bore you with my domestic economy. The dog is demanding to be walked, and I have to go out in a moment.
All right, I fully understand, Edward.
But let me just say, I think that there's a lot of disappointment in the EU based on the theft of intellectual property. Yeah. And this is, when I remember, I used to cover German business and finance back in the 90s, and the German big German companies, from Siemens through to the Mittelstand, saw China as the absolutely, the most dynamic, exciting, wonderful place, not only in terms of cheap manufacturing, but also as a place to sell stuff.
Yeah.
And there were some quite naive expectations, possibly. But that has really soured, and people are absolutely fed up of having their intellectual property stolen in China. They're also very fed up with hacking and having it stolen under their noses in Europe. And I think there's also a real backlash on human rights. And these stories about what's happening in East Turkestan or Xinjiang, to some extent also in Catholic countries, the treatment of the underground church. But it's made people really mind about this. And I think that what's very much shifted from a Chinese point of view is that they used to be able to rely on centre-left parties who would say, we don't have like the Americans, so we'd be nice to China. They've lost the entire left of the political spectrum. And you have to go right out to the sort of hard left Corbynite loonies to find people who actually say, we should be strategically in favour of China.
Could I bring Ivana in? I'm a bit worried about time, Edward. I hate to be rude. I didn't mean to interrupt. Okay.
In that case, I'm going to say goodbye and take the dog out. Thank you so much.
Very good. And I hope your dog enjoys the walk as much as you do, Edward. Thank you again for joining us. Lovely dog. Love the dog. Ivana, if you could, this will have to be the last word. Ivana, any thoughts on China-EU relations? Cherry, fairly pessimistic. We all seem very pessimistic about the future of relationships with China. Have any ray of hope for us?
You're forcing me to be optimistic. So
I am trying my best. Yes.
basically, I think that it's a huge achievement that EU shifted from economic partner towards seeing China as economic partner towards seeing it as a systemic rival. That's quite an achievement. So many years of muddling through and being amazed by the great market and basically this old narrative of that China is unique and there is no other place than China. I mean, we all have to invest there and so on. So I do see a shift in that. And also, though the comprehensive agreement on investment was criticized, and I'm one of the critique of that as well, I do see it as a kind of a package of things which EU and European Commission is trying to push forward on IPR, on guidelines for European universities, how to deal with Chinese partners. So it's a more of a mixture of things which the EU is trying to come up with. So I'm a little bit optimistic that we are actually moving into the direction where we will have a more ground-based discussion with the US on that we may actually see China as a rival as well.
Okay, thanks. I wasn't trying to make you into an optimist, by the way. I never saw you as a pessimist either. I think I read you more as a realist in the old-fashioned realist. But maybe you don't like that term either. I don't know. I don't mind it myself. Cherry, I'd love to bring you in, but I think we kind of run out of time. Firstly, I'd like to say thank you to Ivana. Thank you very much. That was wonderful, Ivana. Lucky to live in Czech Republic, wonderful country. Thank you to Edward, who's just taken his dog out for a walk. That's never happened to me before, I have to say, on a Zoom meeting, but there we are. Thank you, Edward. I hope you can hear me, or your dog can hear me. And Cherry Eugene, once again, wonderful to have you on this particular panel, which I think opened up a whole range of issues and discussed in exactly the right tone. And with exactly the same respect for each other, which needs to be done in the world we're living in at the moment, where I'm afraid there's not too much respect shown to each other in terms of different opinions. There is a short feedback form for all those who joined us. Many, over 80 joined us today, which is a very fine number on a Friday afternoon here in London, but not around the world. Be grateful if you could take 1 minute to tell us what you thought of the event. And by the way, the event, I should have mentioned this at the beginning, but I did mention it in the middle. It was also held in partnership with the RATIU Forum, friends of ours, a Romanian-based organization partnered with LSE Ideas that supports liberal democracy in the region. Thank you for joining us today. We hope you found it interesting and informative. We hope you will be joining us at another event soon. Please check out the LSE website, and all the best here from LSE Ideas, the think tank of the LSE on foreign and strategic policy. So thanks again to everybody, and have a very nice evening. or very nice morning, but probably evening. So goodbye, everybody. Ivana again, Cherry again. And thanks to Dave Sutton and all the team at LSE Ideas for doing such a fantastic job, as always. Goodbye, everybody, and have a very nice weekend.